From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Young people have had jobs since forever. The problem, say some, is when there are no limits to that employment.
We're getting rid of almost all of the regulations for so many of these minors.
Also this week, Florida may crack down even more on make-believe military veterans.
In saying they are something that they are not, it cheapens that service in every way, shape, and form, and it is not okay.
We'll also talk about lost state vehicles, immigration, state constitutional amendments, just a bunch of things. I'm Tom Flanagan, online and on air. This is Capitol Report and the end-of-week wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com.
Florida lawmakers rolled back some of the state's child labor protections last year. Now, Tristan Wood reports a proposal is advancing in Tallahassee that would strip them completely for those age 16 and older.
The rollback would allow 16 and 17-year-olds to work full-time, including late nights and days longer than 8 hours, even on school nights. And the teens wouldn't get required breaks. The proposal would also waive those protections for 14 and 15-year-olds if they are enrolled in high school, virtual education, or have already graduated and received a high school diploma. Tampa Republican Senator Jay Collins says the move is about giving parents and their families choices.
I believe that parents are best suited to take care of their kids and manage their schedules and make sure that they're doing what's best for them. I don't understand why the state needs to go beyond the federal regulations.
While the proposal passed its first committee, it's getting bipartisan opposition. Democrats say they think the bill is an attempt to fill an anticipated workforce shortage as efforts increase to deport undocumented immigrants. They pointed to this comment made recently by Governor Ron DeSantis.
What's wrong with expecting, like, our young people to be working part-time now? I mean, like, that's how it used to be when I was growing up. Why do we say we need to import foreigners, even import them illegally, when, you know, teenagers used to work at these resorts? College students should be, all this stuff.
About 100,000 teens are currently working at least part-time in Florida. Orlando Democratic State Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith worries they'll face pressure from their employers to work full-time.
We're somehow going to solve the current labor shortage that we have in Florida that was worsened with anti-immigrant rhetoric with child labor. For the record, we know that minors already are eligible to work part-time. They're already working these jobs, and that's okay with regulations. The problem is that we're getting rid of almost all of the regulations for so many of these minors.
Sarasota Republican Senator Joe Gruters also opposes the bill.
I think we need to let kids be kids. I think the guardrails that we're removing, even though it's maybe a part of federal law, not in favor of it. I think last week we voted for that opt-out of minimum wage because minors couldn't get jobs and we were trying to give them more opportunities. I just think it sets this sends a bad message, and I think we should allow kids to work the hours that they're allowed now with the waiver system, and that's it.
After the bill passed its committee, Senate President Ben Albritton told reporters he's not sure whether he will support it.
I've yet to develop a certainty on that. I'm still looking at that. Still want to understand ramifications. I certainly am sensitive to the governor's perspective, as he is mine. And, you know, we'll see where that thing lands.
Where Albritton eventually comes down could impact whether the bill passes this session, because the Senate president wields power over what bills are heard on the floor after they pass committees. Florida isn't alone in considering changes to its child labor policies. John Flitter, a political science professor at Kansas State University, says rolling back child labor laws has been a growing trend in Republican-controlled states since 2016. He says some see it as a solution to national labor shortages without relying on immigration.
We've got low unemployment. There's a labor shortage. So I think a lot of these groups are taking advantage of that situation by saying, hey, you know, we need to let kids work here because, you know, work is good for them. And, you know, we need to have more people enter the workforce.
More than a dozen states since 2018 have passed legislation reducing child labor protections. I'm Tristan Wood.
Florida lawmakers are rolling out punishments for stolen valor. The state Senate passed a measure making the act a third-degree felony for anyone misrepresenting their military service, including wearing unauthorized uniforms. We get more on that story from Adrian Andrews.
Supporters called the legislation a win for all military service members, saying it protects the sanctity of the uniform. Brevard Republican Senator Tom Wright championed the measure. He says the bill would amend state statutes to consolidate all military branches into one single classification under Florida's Stolen Valor Law.
Currently, each branch of the military is listed individually in each section. The bill ensures that all the same branches of the armed forces are listed in each provision of the statute.
Under the bill, anyone caught lying about their military service or wearing a service uniform with medals and awards that they never received could face a third-degree felony. Wright, in a recent committee, pointed to examples where people in his district posed as military veterans and started taking money as part of a fake charity. He says if passed, his bill would put an end to such acts.
Men are wearing fatigues and claim to be veterans, and they're not collecting money for veterans. And I have talked to the store managers in both cases, and they've thrown them off the property. So we have to protect the sanctity of the uniform.
Wright's bill would apply to people wearing service uniforms as part of a Halloween costume, but the bill does give performing actors a pass. Wright wanted to make that clear early on in committees.
Is there a Halloween exception?
No military insignias whatsoever. You got to be a bunny or something else.
A similar measure that specifically takes aim at public officials using stolen valor to win elections also cleared the Senate floor. Retired U.S. Army soldier and Tampa Republican Senator Jay Collins is one of the lawmakers behind the proposal. He says stolen valor has been a recurring issue.
If people go around wearing those medals, taking those opportunities and saying they are something that they are not, it cheapens that service in every way, shape, and form, and it is not okay.
Under Collins' measure, elected officials who engage in stolen valor could face a $25,000 fine and be removed from their office by the governor. I'm Adrian Andrews.
Florida lawmakers in 2023 passed a law aimed at starting high school classes later in the morning, pointing to research showing that teens are not getting enough sleep. But 2 years later, with a 2026 deadline looming for school districts to comply, the Florida Senate this week unanimously passed a bill that would undo the law and leave it up to local officials to decide when schools start. The move comes after an outcry from many school districts, which said they're struggling to comply with the deadline because of issues such as a need to buy more buses and hire hard-to-find bus drivers. State Senator Danny Burgess says lawmakers are listening to the feedback from school districts.
Without more resources, without maybe even more time to figure out how we actually implement this in real time with bus driver shortages and the like, we are possibly walking into a minefield that we shouldn't venture into.
Under the current law, high schools could not start earlier than 8:30 in the morning, and middle schools couldn't start earlier than 8 o'clock. A similar House bill is positioned to go to the full chamber. Coming up on Capitol Report, If you've ever forgotten where you parked your car, you might be able to sympathize with the state of Florida agency that's lost track of thousands of vehicles. That even led the guy in charge of the agency to say,
but that was an abominable report.
And we'll get a preview of what, besides the names of various politicians, might be on the 2026 ballot in Florida.
There are already some amendments in the works, gathering signatures for the 2026 ballot as we speak.
In a stunning turn of events, House Speaker Daniel Perez wants to stop paying one of Governor Ron DeSantis's agency heads, who has not been responsive to the legislative committee that controls its budget. Steve Busquet reports from the Capitol.
It's a crisis moment in the Department of Management Services, or DMS. The agency manages all state property and was blasted in a recent audit after losing track of 2,200 state cars and trucks worth $57 million. Then, a House budget panel criticized the agency's hiring decisions, faulting DMS for failing to manage a growing deficit in paying health care for state workers. The leader of the department is Secretary Pedro Allende. When he testified before the committee recently, House members said they'd found his answers evasive. The panel's chair is Republican Representative Vicky Lopez of Miami.
I liken DMS to the house that's on fire, and you can see the fire in every single window of that house if you're looking at it from the outside. It begs immediate attention.
It's rare for Republican lawmakers to criticize a DeSantis administration agency so harshly, especially when the governor is demanding an end to waste and inefficiency in local government. Lawmakers in both parties are outraged that DMS hired four data experts who live in faraway states of Idaho, Maryland, and West Virginia. All four draw six-figure salaries, but they charge their travel to Florida taxpayers when they come to the state. Allende was grilled about Chief State Data Officer Ed Ryan. He's paid $206,000 a year, lives in Maryland, and has billed the state for $42,000 of travel in 2+ years.
I mean, I've certainly entertained the concept of moving to Florida. I can tell you our chief data officer vacations in Florida, loves Florida, family has a home in Daytona, but it's just not the right decision for his family. And I mean, I get it.
The state auditor general issued a devastating report on how poorly DMS tracks 23,000 state-owned vehicles. Representative Bill Partington is a freshman Republican from Ormond Beach.
But that was an abominable report. I mean, I was just shocked. But as a taxpayer, it would enrage me to hear that report coming from my state government. I can only assume that our governor has no idea about this.
If DeSantis didn't know, he will soon enough. With the House Speaker's approval, the same House committee will urge that Allende not be paid his state salary until he answers all of the panel's questions. It's a 2x4, sure to get the governor's attention. Allende will still get his $210,000 a year paycheck because the next budget won't take effect until July. But the House also plans to defund all four of those out-of-state experts. I'm Steve Bosquet.
Governor Ron DeSantis recently signed two laws designed to assist the Trump administration in its efforts to carry out mass deportations. One of those laws directs local officials to use their best efforts to support federal immigration law. All of Florida's 67 county sheriffs and dozens of municipalities have entered into those agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Fort Myers City Council voted last week to direct the city police department to participate, despite overwhelming opposition expressed during public comment. WGCU's Mike Canary talked with ACLU of Florida Executive Director Bacardi Jackson to get her response to these events and recent trends.
Our local municipalities are dealing with this idea of empowering the law enforcement at the local level to act on behalf of ICE It's something that has come down from Washington and also from Tallahassee. The implementation of the Alien Enemies Act, which we just saw targeted towards these gang members, quote unquote, from Venezuela. The news of the day is that the president's lawyers are arguing that the Aliens Act allows them to effectively get rid of the Fourth Amendment protections of being able to enter homes without a warrant. How does the ACLU of Florida respond to that notion?
We are here to fight it. I mean, this is, you know, constitutional law 101. We have to stand up in every way that we can. So we are ready on all of the fronts that we operate on. Legally, we are bringing cases in the courts. Our national office has already brought about 20 cases against the Trump administration. In its first administration, brought over about 450 cases. We brought one case this administration within 9 hours of him being sworn into office. We have a plan. We are ready. We are working. We see this coming every day, but our job is to bring the cases legally. We also are fighting legislatively in all of the ways we can influence our Congress and our state legislatures to act as separate bodies, that they have a role to play in our government as a check and balance on executive power. We are also trying to make sure our judges understand that they have support from the people of this country to be able to interpret the laws as their authority under the Constitution. We have to stand for our government continuing to exist and to not give way to a kingdom or some dictatorship. So fighting against the encroachment of whether it's the federal encroachment on states or the state encroachment on municipalities, that's an important battle. We have to make sure we are showing up at the municipal and city level to make sure that the authority that was given by the people who elected those local officials stands. They should not be changing their votes because they get a threatening call from our governor. They have an obligation to the people who elected them to make a decision about what is in the best interest of the people who live in that locality. They have an obligation to vote with their values that the people put them there to vote for. And if you are going to be making a decision about how you're going to take your municipality's resources, the taxpayer dollars that are already allocated for your local police department to provide safety in other ways, and you're going to usurp that decision and decide that you're going to just, oh, because we want to play politics and we want to make a dictator happy, that we're going to totally change our already existing allocation of those resources, that makes no sense. And so it is so important for the people to show up and help shore up those courageous and brave officials who will continue to stand by their authority. It's important for us to make sure we are telling people what's happening and to let the governor know this is not acceptable, to let our legislators know this is not acceptable. You don't get to come in and Bigfoot the home rule and the local authority of city officials.
That was WGCU's Mike Canary speaking with ACLU of Florida Executive Director Bacardi Jackson. Each year, a group of young people who have been in foster care comes to Tallahassee to lobby during the legislative session. They're called Florida Youth Shine. They've been around since 2002, and they're still helping to reform Florida's foster care system. Margie Menzel reports.
There are about 350 members of Youth Shine now in 11 chapters around the state. Roughly 30 of them came to Tallahassee this year, and they visited lawmakers and groups to talk about the two bills they're backing.
Right now, we lead the charge in keeping siblings together. However, there's really no clear path on how siblings that maybe are not in care or aged out of care can continue their relationships with those that are still within the system.
That's Dominique Rosario, one of the group lobbying Orlando Democratic Representative Anna Escamani. One of their bills would allow visitations between youth in state care and their siblings who have left state care, or the other way around.
And so what we're asking for in this bill is just to have a clear pathway for those siblings that aren't in care or maybe are in care and their sibling is not, to be able to visit with each other, have that relationship, and maintain those connections. Because when we sever them, that is so detrimental to the youth's outcomes.
Escamani says she gets it, that she grew even closer to her brother and sister after their mom died when she was 13.
And so to have that sibling that you can talk to, it's a big, and each other too. I mean, that's why Florida East Giant is so important, just to have the connectivity.
These are my siblings.
Yeah, I was going to say.
That was T. Lamore saying the members of Youth Shine are like her brothers and sisters. Another Youth Shine member, Skylar Cross, agrees. Besides Youth Shine, he also has three siblings. He says all four of them went into foster care when he was 12.
Three of us were in one place, and then the other one was in a different home, and then we all kind of just kept getting separated from there. It was pretty bad. I mean, once you already lose, like, your parents and your family, and then you start to lose, like, your siblings, it's just pretty rough, you know?
The other bill Youth Shine is backing is a federal housing voucher. Currently, there's a program that helps former foster youth with rental assistance for up to 3 years. But it's only available in 11 of Florida's 100-plus housing authorities. This bill would make it statewide. According to the National Alliance to End Homelessness, between 31% and 46% of youth exiting foster care experience homelessness by age 26. Youth Shine member Sean Ford is doing all right now. He's in college and has his own apartment. But he recalls a childhood of homeless shelters and couch surfing.
It really started to, like, affect how I looked out on the world. Because usually it's like, as a kid, you look forward to things, growing up, driving, doing this and doing that. But the only thing I could look forward to is, where am I going to go? Where am I going to do? Where am I going to stay? And that's very mentally taxing for somebody that young. Because I'm like, when this is happening, I'm like 12, 13, 14, 15.
The Youth Shine advocates also visited the Florida Senate chamber, where they learned to propose a bill, debate a bill, and vote on a bill. Then Senate President Ben Albritton stepped into the chamber and took over the presiding. Albritton has been involved with many of the same historical reforms that Youth Shine has. He says he's always advocated for kids because they're the future.
You know, and when you really step back and you think about kids that may have been through an abusive home life or had some kind of trauma in their life, it is absolutely the role of the state of Florida to step in for those children and try best we can to help bring healing and to move away from that trauma, to give them hope, right? That's it.
Both the House and Senate will take up the housing voucher bills in committee on Monday. The sibling visitation bills have yet to be agendized. I'm Margie Menzel.
Florida's unemployment rate in February ticked up for the second month in a row. The Florida Department of Commerce today said the unemployment rate increased from 3.5% in January to 3.6% in February. The February rate reflects an estimated 398,000 Floridians qualified as out of work, and that's out of a total labor force of nearly 11.2 million. The number of unemployed people and the labor force each increased by about 8,000 people in February. According to a Department of Commerce report, the jobless rate was up from a near historic low of 3.2% 1 year ago. Jimmy Heckman is the chief economist for the State Department of Commerce.
Over the last year, these incremental increases in the unemployment rate have come alongside labor force growth.
The report shows that employment in the state's leisure and hospitality sector lost jobs last month. Meanwhile, construction and manufacturing gained positions. The national unemployment rate last month was 4.1%. You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, state lawmakers are considering changes to how a proposed constitutional amendment gets on the ballot. The Your Florida team looked at how the process works now. Reporters Megan Bowman and Douglas Soule are here to break it down for us, starting with how members of the legislature can create a proposed amendment.
First, a lawmaker has to file it as a bill in the legislative body, and that bill needs to be approved by both the Senate and the House by a 3/5 vote. It's important to point out that Republicans currently have a supermajority in the Florida legislature, so if the party wants it, it could easily pass.
Okay. What are some examples?
This legislative session, there are several moving proposed constitutional amendments. One of them would set, for example, term limits on county commissioners and school board members. Another would eliminate the lieutenant governor position and create a quote-unquote commissioner of government efficiency, and another would prevent increased property taxes when improvements are made to harden homes against hurricanes.
All right, so you've just talked about how lawmakers can get an amendment on the ballot. Can you tell me about another popular method, one where citizens can ask voters to add something to the state constitution?
Yeah, that's a big one. You know, in recent years, Florida voters have approved medical marijuana, higher minimum wage, voting rights for people once imprisoned for felonies. Those are all things that citizen groups put on the ballot and citizens approved. It's kind of a hard process to do, and lawmakers have made it harder and more expensive in recent years through various laws. To get a citizens' initiative proposed constitutional amendment on the ballot, you need to get nearly 900,000 Floridian signatures. And after that, it then must go to the Florida Supreme Court for review. Justices must decide if that proposed amendment's language adheres to a single subject and is not misleading.
Great. So at this point, amendments pitched by citizens or lawmakers heads to the ballot.
From there, it does go on the ballot, but it has to be approved by at least 60% of voters, which is a high threshold, a higher threshold than most states have.
Do you have some examples?
There are already some amendments in the works, gathering signatures for the 2026 ballot as we speak. One would bring recreational marijuana to the state. Another would provide constitutional protections for home insurance holders. And yet another would expand Medicaid coverage if it passes.
Right now, there are bills trying to change how citizen-led amendments get to the ballot. Fill me in.
So lawmakers are trying to make some adjustments to the citizens' petition process. Now, the GOP supporters of this move say it would prevent fraud. Many Democrats and voting rights advocates accuse this move of being an attempt to silence citizens and to stifle that very process. Under one bill, someone who collects petitions beyond immediate family members and two others would have to register with the state and undergo training. And if you don't do that, you would face a felony. Yet another proposal would ban signature collecting from third-party groups. Now, the process of signature collecting is very expensive in the state of Florida. So banning that third-party group participation would have huge monumental effects on that process and make it a lot harder for many groups to successfully cross the finish line in terms of collecting signatures.
That was state government reporter Douglas Soule speaking with your Florida's Megan Bowman. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Adrian Andrews, Regan McCarthy, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Steve Busquet, Mike Canary, Megan Bowman, and Douglas Soule. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. HR Florida State Council, affiliate of the Society of Human Resource Management, advocating for the workplace on behalf of 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council. More at hrflorida.org. The Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 1 million union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.